The Guardian.
Parliament giveth.
Let me say in response, Mr. Speaker, how welcome it is, even joyful, that for the first time in this long saga, this House has actually accepted its responsibilities together, come together and embraced a deal.
Yeah. And Parliament taketh away.
But Mr. Speaker, I must express my disappointment that the House has again voted for delay, rather than a timetable that would have guaranteed that the UK would be in a position to leave the EU on October the 31st with a deal.
I'm Heather Stewart, and this is Politics Weekly. On Tuesday night, Boris Johnson managed to do something Theresa May never could. He got a Brexit deal that was passed by Parliament. Almost immediately afterwards, that same Parliament voted down his motion to fast-track that deal through in time for next week's 31st of October deadline. Straight after the vote, the Prime Minister paused the legislation until he hears back from Brussels on what they've decided in terms of another extension. It looks as if the EU27 will grant the three-month delay. If it does so, the PM has threatened to pull the bill and push for an election. But for now, the legislation is simply paused. So, will we leave on the 31st? Will we have an extension until the end of January? Will we have an election before Christmas? Will this ever end? And with 19 Labour MPs going against the party line and voting in favour of Boris Johnson's withdrawal agreement, where does Jeremy Corbyn's party stand ahead of a potential election? And will those rebel MPs be punished or rewarded by voters? We'll also look at the race for the Speaker and the legacy that John Bercow will leave when he steps down from the chair on the 31st of October. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, Prime Minister's questions was heated as usual on Wednesday as Boris Johnson and leaders of opposition parties went tête-à-tête on the various points of contention arising from his deal. Johnson's response, if you don't like my deal, let's go to the polls and let the people decide. The SNP's Ian Blackford said they're in favour of an election once the Brexit extension is secured. But the Lib Dems are still fighting for a second EU referendum. Corbyn says his party will accept an election if we get a three-month extension, but some in the party, including Keir Starmer, are still holding out hope for putting Johnson's bill to a referendum. So, what will the Prime Minister do next? To discuss all of this, I'm joined by Guardian columnist Polly Toynbee, Jill Rutter of UK in a Changing Europe, and The Atlantic's Tom McTague. So, Tom, he got a deal passed in Parliament. That's an achievement we maybe didn't think was possible.
I totally agree. I think that is the most significant moment of the week. For the first time in this entire process, we have a majority in the House of Commons for Brexit in principle. To get it over the line, what comes next is an entirely different question, and he doesn't have a majority for his vision of a harder Brexit. But the fact we now have a majority assembled, a Tory party united, even with those people that he expelled are now with Boris Johnson, plus nine Labour MPs, that is a crucial moment. And I think it's very hard for those pushing for a second referendum to where do they go from here? How do they assemble a majority for that? That looks almost impossible now.
And Jill, just explain to us what MPs were voting for at that second reading. I know from having to write stories about these things, it's quite hard to explain to the poor baffled readers, listeners. But what was it MPs were effectively voting for?
Second reading is essentially a vote on the principle. Are you prepared to let the government bring in this legislation? And is it worth the government's while debating it? Because if MPs don't support it in principle, there's absolutely no point in wasting people's time going through it line by line. So this was, in a sense, you know, we've talked about meaningful votes and things like that. We've had four of those and the government tried to sneak in another one on Monday, didn't get that way. But in a sense, it did the same as a meaningful vote would have done, of say, actually, is there support in principle for proceeding with Brexit? And that's why, as Tom said, it's a really significant moment that MPs, for the first time, all we've had before is majorities against no deal. We've never had a majority for a vision of Brexit. And that's what Boris Johnson, very surprisingly, reflecting on the last couple of weeks, secured.
Polly, Boris Johnson now has quite a big decision to make, doesn't he? Ken Clark stood up at PMQs and said, you know, forget this Halloween deadline next week. This, I'd rather be dead in a ditch than not leave on that particular date. Just spend a couple more months on this and get it through and leave.
That certainly seems to make a lot more sense. There is nothing special about the 31st of October. It's a random date. It happens to be Halloween. There is no reason except that, of course, Boris Johnson kept saying do or die, die in a ditch, swore that against all of the evidence that he would be out by that day. I don't even think that's that embarrassing for him, because he can always turn around and say, look, this is what Parliament is forcing me to do. I don't think anybody reasonable would say he has somehow broken his promise or betrayed his position. But I don't know whether he seems to think that people will mind about that. I mean, a lot of people may want it to stop or want it to progress, but I don't think that date's very crucial.
Tom, it is possible, isn't it? Also, though, that this majority of 30, which was pretty healthy for the second reading, could melt away at a later stage during the parliamentary process.
Totally. I mean, it's one of the most precarious majorities you can imagine. It's full of people who don't agree with him on the very basics of Brexit. You know, they don't want a hard version of Brexit. Some of the Labour MPs, a lot of the Tory MPs actually, don't really want what he is selling, but they have come together, perhaps out of a sense of, dread of what will happen if they don't come together, so a sense of survival. But that is a precarious majority. I think it's still important, though, to say that it is a majority for Brexit in principle.
Not really, though, because an awful lot of those Labour MPs want to be able to say to their constituents, look, I voted for it in principle. But when it comes to the practice, and the practice is pretty horrible, this is a much, as far as they're concerned, a much worse deal than the one Theresa May had. They're not going to vote for it unless it's much amended.
But then the political cost of that goes up and up and up. So this is the skill that number 10, I think we have to sort of accept, that they are making it more politically costly for the opposition to stop Brexit every move they make, whether it's taking the government to court or all sorts of other ways, or whether it's allowing a second reading and then blocking it. Do the public understand what is happening, or do they just see people blocking Brexit again? And it feels like we're in an election campaign, and every time he loses, it's like a political alchemy. He can turn it into a victory, and then he sells that on the doorstep.
I mean, it's an interesting question. If the bill went forward, how prepared to accept commitments in domestic legislation is Boris Johnson to get Brexit done? Because actually, all the substance of what Brexit really looks like is not for now, that's for the long-term relationship. So you could argue, if you were Boris Johnson, you know, we think there'd probably be a customs union amendment. Ken Clark tabled one for the debate yesterday. If it says seek to negotiate a customs union, Boris Johnson could accept that. Then he knows if he came back with a majority after an election, he could say, let's seek to negotiate. Yeah, I'm not going to do that. And just overturn it. It's domestic legislation. It's not in the withdrawal treaty. Equally, he could put in loads and loads of things about observing rights on this, protecting the environment, whatever else he wants. But if he's got a majority after an election, he can do away with all that. He can overturn any of those sorts of commitments.
I think that what you've said, Jill, is really important, that I don't think a lot of people on the Labour side, well, indeed right across the House, have understood the extent to which these amendments will be easy to wipe away after an election.
If there's a majority, it all hangs on getting a majority.
Yes. I mean, if the Conservatives were to get a majority after an election, which may be very soon, whatever agreements have been made through amendments, you may think we've won a wonderful victory on getting a customs union or getting all of those rights cemented in. Nothing is, unless it's actually on the legal side of the withdrawal agreement bill itself. And I think that's going to sink in, and then there will be a much stronger pushback against this whole operation, because everything comes later and everything will depend on who wins the election.
I mean, that's a really interesting difference with Theresa May's deal, where because of the backstop, effectively a fallback of being in a customs union with the EU, and because the EU put in those level playing field conditions on workers' rights, the environment, those were actually in an international treaty.
Yeah.
It had a very different status, and actually that's one reason why quite a lot of us were saying, you know, if you're a Labour leaver, you know, this is actually a pretty good deal for you in that withdrawal agreement. You may not like her destination, but actually this gives you an awful lot of guarantees. And those aren't in Johnson's deal. And I think that's a really interesting difficulty that some of those Labour leavers have now found themselves in, that because of the imperative to be seen to be supporting Leave, they're supporting A leave with far fewer guarantees than the one they were being offered back in the early part of the year.
And yet, in the end, 19 of them went through the lobbies with the government last night and voted for this deal to continue in principle. We spoke to one of them, Gareth Snell, yesterday afternoon and asked him what the considerations he was weighing up when deciding how to vote.
I want to get to the committee stage, and I know that sounds a bit of a fudge, but I want to get to the part of this debate where we actually get to do amendments, where we get to try and improve the bill, where we get to get into the guts of what it really is and try and make it better. So I'll vote for the second reading, but I'm not sure what I will do on the programme motion.
And Labour's line, Jeremy Corbyn's line, is that Labour MP should vote against this deal. Why do you feel you're doing the right thing by your constituents voting for it to continue its passage through Parliament? What are the arguments you're considering?
Well, my constituency voted overwhelmingly to leave, so I think part of it is respecting that. But at the same time, voting for it at second reading does not mean signing it off in its full and final form. You can easily vote for second reading, go into the committee stage and have a really good bash at trying to get that customs union, trying to get even greater protections for workers' rights, make sure that there's a clear role for Parliament going forward. You can do all of that at committee stage, and if you are not successful, then you still have options available at third reading, which is when this would all come to an end. So I understand and I respect what the Labour Party's position is. They don't think the deal is good enough at all. I'm in a position where I want to get a deal, and the best chance of getting a better deal is to take the one we've got and try and beat it into a better shape.
So you're reserving the right to vote against it at a later stage in the proceedings if you're not happy with how it's amended during that committee stage?
Absolutely, and Lisa Nandy said that today to the Prime Minister, that those that vote for it at second reading today, our votes are not a given for third reading, and there is still a lot of work to do. And again, if the Prime Minister had given himself just one more extra day, we could probably have got this bill into a much better position that would have made third reading much easier for everybody. As it happens, he hasn't, so we'll see how it transpires.
And Gareth, one more question. We're probably going to be heading towards a general election sooner rather than later. Whether it's before Christmas or after, we don't quite know yet. What do you say to those Labour MPs who say we should be a Remain party? We should go into that election saying we'll have a referendum, we'll support Remain.
We are the party for the many, not the few, as is often said. And that means that we have to work for the 48% and the 52%. And, you know, if people that say we should just concentrate on Remain voters, I would say to you and say to them, 36,000 people voted Remain in Stoke-on-Trent. 58,000 people voted Labour at the general election the year later, and we lost a seat. It is not as simple as saying that every Remain voter will be Labour. And even if it was, in places like Stoke, that simply isn't enough to win.
Polly, can you understand the instincts of Labour MPs like Gareth Snell, who think they're doing right by their constituents by supporting this?
It's an interesting divide between those Labour MPs in leave seats who go one way and those who go the other. People like Snell are saying we have to follow the wishes of our constituents. But there are quite a lot of other Labour MPs. If you look at Mary Cray in Wakefield, if you look at Bridget Phillipson in Sunderland, they have taken the opposite view. They're in strongly leave constituencies, but they say it is our duty not to follow cravenly whatever they want, but to do what's best for them and to argue with them and to lead rather than follow. That's a very brave position, and you can understand why some people fold in the face of a very heavily leave voting constituency.
Tom, if you were Boris Johnson listening to that, thinking, gosh, a lot of these votes might fall away at some later stage, my majority might not be as stable as I think, would you just be tempted to go for an election now?
I'd keep pushing. I'd keep pushing them and make them pay a higher political cost for pulling their support at a later date.
So keep going with the bill and you know, every time stand up at the dispatch box and say Labour's blocked this, Labour's...
Absolutely, and just keep ramping up the pressure. I mean, as Polly says, you know, there are Labour MPs who have been brave and outspoken very early on, people like Bridget Phillipson in Sunderland, who has just taken a position and she's going to defend it. I think that the ones that are coming out of this worst of all are those that are saying that they are pro-Brexit and they're not supporting it, and not supporting Theresa May's deal, which locked in international law, as we were talking about earlier, rights that they wanted. So some of the Labour MPs, and you have to say the DUP, have made some pretty enormous strategic miscalculations on this, and Boris Johnson and the Tories are now foot to the floor, united, and squeezing them for all they've got.
And meanwhile, Jill Johnson has done a fairly good job of lumping Labour leadership, Labour MPs, much of his own, well, some of his own backbenchers too, into this sort of this blob of kind of Parliament, you know, stopping me getting what I want. You know, he eventually sent that letter, didn't he, on Saturday, requesting a delay, as in the Benn Act. But somehow it's, you know, it's not his delay, it's Parliament's delay. It's not my fault.
I think, you know, it's really interesting. I think this is a major piece of constitutional legislation. MPs had not seen any of this in draft before. Most of it could have been published yonks ago, because most of it's exactly the same as Theresa May's bill. There's some changes, but not really that many. But it is completely ridiculous to say Parliament should only have 2 days, two and a bit days to look at it. The Commons should only have two and a bit days to look at it. There are lots of nasties buried in that bill that Parliament would regret at length if it doesn't have at least a sort of go at getting some of those out. I mean, you know, things like citizens' rights. I mean, the way in which the UK proposes to guarantee the rights of EU citizens, when we turn off your ability to apply for settled status, the way in which we construct this sort of, you know, we don't trust the Home Office body called the Independent Monitoring Authority. We're all talking about Windrush 2 being stored up. This is MP's opportunity to try and put in some safeguards against that. So I really think that actually Parliament should sort of fight back and say, no, Prime Minister, apart from this artificial deadline, okay, it's a deadline EU law, but the EU would have always granted a technical extension of a few weeks to do some proper scrutiny on this. And actually, it's in EU countries' interest too, because that's protecting their citizens who are here, who have big vested interests in us getting this right. We actually need to do our job, and you're not letting us do our job properly. So I think Parliament is right.
Best example of what you're saying was when Steve Barclay himself, in front of a committee in the Lords, couldn't get right one of the most fundamental things. In the future, will businesses in Northern Ireland, crossing over the Irish Sea to the rest of the UK, will they have to actually fill out customs forms and have checks? And first he said no, and then he said, oh, yes. Now, that's really crucial. And as far as the DUP, for most people in Northern Ireland are concerned, that is a shocking difference. To have to cross a border into a part of your own country, and Barclay had not got his head around that. So how many, as you say, how many more wicked issues, nasties, are locked away in those 115
pages? And Boris Johnson
pages?
Couldn't explain the consent mechanism yesterday when he actually got it wrong when he was talking about it. Julian Smith just seems to have been given quite a torrid session from the DUP and the Northern Ireland Affairs Committee this morning. So there are a lot of issues that really Parliament should be grappling with. Of course, actually, lots of this aren't on the face of the bill, because one of the other things the government is doing is arming itself with lots of powers to make this all through secondary legislation, partly because actually they're not ready in quite a lot of these areas, not least the arrangements for Northern Ireland, which were only finalised last week in Europe.
And Jill, when MPs are considering this deal, they don't have, do they, a proper economic assessment from the Treasury to look at, to work out what the pros and cons might be?
No, the Chancellor hasn't accompanied this with an economic assessment. What they could look at is the government's own economic analysis published in November last year, which actually was sort of pretty honest about the sort of possibilities. And they could look at one of the scenarios, which was called a moderate FTA, a moderate free trade agreement, and say, well, that's possibly where we end up. We might add a little bit on, and they would see that is worse than staying as an EU membership, it's worse than membership of the EEA and the Customs Union. Or they could just take the view, like Sajid Javid clearly takes the view, that it's not about the economy, stupid. Brexit fundamentally was never the choice of 99.9% of economists. You want Brexit because it's about the sort of country you want to be, all of these things. And actually, a few percentage points on GDP are a price worth paying for Brexit. And
pretty
if you
much
do that,
said that,
do
didn't
that.
He? You can't measure the value to democracy on a spreadsheet.
It's pretty much the view. It's not the economy, stupid. I mean, that's the Chancellor's view. Slightly unusual.
But usually it's something you hear from the Treasury, is it?
No, I mean, the interesting time is the next time we will see this more seriously is when the OBR has to do a forecast for the budget. And then we ought to see what the OBR's assessment, all these forecasts, all these analyses we've seen are at some sort of slightly distant point, 10, 15 years in the future. And they don't actually say what happens in absolute terms to the economy. They're saying relative to a future in which we were a member of the EU. But the OBR has to take as its basis government policy. And so it will have to produce the forecast for the next budget on the basis of the vision of Brexit that the government has now agreed. So, and that will be covering the next 5 years, which is sort of OBR forecast period. So we'll then see the official assessment of what does Brexit look like. People all said Theresa May was offering a blind Brexit. They're now being offered an even blinder Brexit by Boris Johnson.
OK, we'll leave that there for now, but there's plenty more to talk about. We'll come back to Brexit later. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. Now, as well as the Brexit deadline looming, one of the biggest current parliamentary personalities, the Speaker, John Bercow, has said he'll step down on October the 31st. The House of Commons can't function without a Speaker, so we're going to get a new one quite soon afterwards. But what exactly does the Speaker do? Who's in the mix to take over after Bercow steps down from the chair? And how do they plan to follow on from the current Speaker's legacy? The Guardian's political correspondent Peter Walker has this report.
The Speaker, in the most basic terms, is the person who chairs the debates in the Commons, who decides who speaks, how long they can talk for, but they have to adjudicate on lots of other matters. So, for example, we saw with John Bercow earlier this week that he didn't allow the government to present their meaningful vote on the Brexit deal twice.
Today's circumstances are in substance the same as Saturday's circumstances. My ruling is therefore that the motion will not be debated today, as it would be repetitive and disorderly to do so.
But they have a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff too. They're basically responsible for the management of the Commons. Everything from the kind of workplace culture, and John Bercow has criticism for not doing enough over kind of bullying of people who work in the Palace of Westminster, but also everything from just making sure even the catering works. It's this kind of astonishingly multifaceted job, and almost sitting in the Speaker's chair is probably the smallest part of it. Bercow steps down on October the 31st, and then on November the 4th we have a special session which is chaired by Kenneth Clarke, the Conservative MP, who's in place as the kind of longest continuously serving member. And all the Speaker candidates, and there's going to be anything up to 9 of them, will make a brief presentation to the Commons and to say why they want to get the job. And then there's a series of votes. It's all a secret ballot. And they do a series of votes, eliminating one person after another until eventually you get one. Even though the process doesn't take place for a couple of weeks, there's been this kind of unofficial campaigning going on for quite some time.
Whatever happens over these next few weeks, the new Speaker is going to face a lot of challenges immediately, and the new Speaker is going to be thrown into the deep end. I think, having been Deputy Speaker for 6 years, at least I have an idea how to swim. I
think that Eleanor Lang is a Conservative MP, but like the Speaker, she doesn't vote because she's one of two Deputy Speakers who basically fill in the role when John Bercow can't be there, because obviously the Commons sits a long time and John Bercow works fairly long hours, but he can't be there every single moment. And she's also one of the people who's going to be standing for the job, so I spoke to her about what she wants to do.
I think that mutual respect is terribly important, and it is true that keeping order in the chair can sometimes be a bit of a challenge, but I really hope that when I have done it, I've done it in a way that has never been discourteous or demeaning to my colleagues. The occupant of the chair can't expect to gain respect unless they also show respect to colleagues.
I asked her what she thought about the current Speaker, John Bercow, and, you know, how she'd be different. And she's quite diplomatic about it. Obviously, you know, he's a kind of work colleague, but she's quite clear on what she'd do differently.
John Bercow has been an amazing Speaker. He set out to change the role, and he's done that. He has achieved a huge amount in bringing Parliament just about into the 21st century. He has his own inimitable style. He has also been slightly controversial in the way in which he has helped Parliament hold the government to account. Sometimes the government gets a bit annoyed about that. Sometimes that has made things rather more difficult for the government. But I don't think he's wrong in doing that.
One of the things I also asked Eleanor Lang about is something that I think, if I was a speaker, which luckily I'm not, I'd find very difficult, and that's remembering the names and faces and local areas of 650 different MPs. So I asked her how on earth they do that and, you know, if she's ever got it wrong.
Yes, it's not always easy. It's particularly difficult at the beginning of a new parliament, which I had to do in 2015 and then again in 2017. There were a lot of new MPs in both of those parliaments. It gets much easier. Now we're 2 years into a new parliament. I've only once notably made a mistake. And then the member I had called was furious with me because the member whose name I had used by mistake was 20 years older than him and he didn't think he lived there. apart from that, I hope I haven't actually made any mistakes. It's not always easy. It takes a lot of concentration. You have to just get the photographs of the new people and make yourself remember them.
One of the other MPs who've put their hat in the ring is Chris Bryant, who is a Labour MP. He's a long-serving Labour MP who is a kind of bit of a parliamentary geek, even though I think he'd quite happily call himself that. He's written a two-volume history of Parliament. I also spoke to him because he really, really wants to be Speaker.
I love Parliament itself. I believe in parliamentary democracy. That's partly because when I was a child, we lived in Spain under Franco, so I know what a dictatorship feels like. And in fact, then, when I trained to be a priest, I did part of that in Argentina and in Chile, and some of my friends had been tortured, and then some of my friends in Chile were subsequently murdered by the dictatorship. So I believe in parliamentary democracy, and I think we've got some problems at the moment. At the heart of that, in our system at least, is having an independent speaker, which is why I've said hundreds of times now, I want to be an umpire, not a player. It's not about, you know, the speaker mouthing off about this, that and the next thing. It's about making sure that there is good order, that there's respect across the chamber. You know, I like to use a little bit of light, gentle humour. I think that means I would be able to respond in the chair to the kind of changing moods in the chamber, which can, and it can change on a sixpence sometimes. But I'm also determined to make sure that we do a better job of running the building in a way that is efficient and make sure that it's a safe environment for everybody to work.
He was basically saying that he admires a lot of the stuff that John Bercow has done, for example, giving MPs more scope to scrutinise the government. But he was quite open about how he'd approach it slightly differently.
So I'm not going to say anything now which I haven't said directly to John's face. John's done lots of good things. You know, we have a nursery in Parliament, which we didn't used to have. We have an education centre. Thousands more kids get to visit the place. We have urgent questions, which mean that the government have to defend their position on a daily basis. I love all of that. I think sometimes in the chair he gets a bit, I don't know, well, he goes over the top. I mean, sometimes he puts people down in a very nasty way. On Monday, he had a right old go at Bernard Jenkin. And as it happened, I agreed with the Speaker on the substance rather than with Bernard. But I just thought there was no need for a long lecture from the chair. So I left the room. I couldn't bear it.
Difference of opinion is of the essence of politics. There is an elaborate combination of finger wagging and head shaking going on, which may be personally therapeutic, but is institutionally disadvantageous.
He's very much made the job his own. It would be good to think that his legacy will carry on in the fact that MPs will have more power, but he does have this slightly kind of pompous or even grating approach to it, and it's fair to say that John Bercow is someone who likes the sound of his own voice more than most people do.
Thanks to Peter Walker there for that report. Now, following on from the discussion earlier, Tom, one of the decisions that Labour is going to have to make is, will it support a general election and when, isn't it? Boris Johnson has to decide, does he want to go to the polls if this extension is agreed? Jeremy Corbyn in the past has Labour's blocked this general election idea twice, hasn't it? Because Boris Johnson needs a two-thirds majority. Is Labour going to be able to hold out for much longer?
I think it's the crucial question for Labour. I mean, let's go back to basics and say this is Labour's trump card, right? This is the power they have over the Prime Minister. They can just say, keep saying no to things. If Polly is right and those Labour MPs who supported Boris Johnson on second reading, if they withdraw their support, Boris Johnson can't get his deal through. If he then goes for an election, Labour have the power and the numbers to block that. So what does Boris Johnson do then? We're just in complete stasis. So there are big problems for the Labour Party if they do that. Somebody described it as keeping Boris Johnson turning on the spit. Just leave him there.
What a horrible image.
Horrible image. But that's the idea. Make him suffer. But Boris Johnson can turn that on the Labour Party and say, well, you've been doing that for a while. My numbers have been going up in the polls because I'm essentially using the time you're giving me to campaign. So thank you very much. I'll keep campaigning. You still haven't answered your fundamental question on Brexit. What do you think? Are you going to go for a second referendum now or after an election? So it's an opportunity, but it comes with some costs for the Labour Party.
Polly, if you were a Labour MP, would you support a general election if Boris Johnson asked for one?
I would say that Labour has another lever as well, which is to go on saying, as Peter Kyle has put forward, you can get this deal through. You can get this deal through quite easily on the condition that you put it to a referendum. And to keep putting that forward, to say, we will agree, we're not uncooperative, we'll let you have your deal, but we just think the people should decide. And I don't think, because Labour itself is split over that, they haven't put it forward very forcefully. But it is a genuine lever and quite an effective one.
Yeah, I think there was a bit of a ding-dong about it at Shadow Cabinet this week. Jill, do you think Labour would benefit from holding out? Or is Boris Johnson just going to carry on calling Jeremy Corbyn chicken and capitalise on it?
I think it is quite a difficult look once an extension is agreed. I mean, Labour did say that was their condition. Take no deal off the table, then we'll give you your election. Quite difficult to then say, we're still quite a long way behind in the polls, so that election we're not so keen on it, particularly if the bill runs aground again, I think, in which case Boris Johnson can say, well, actually, this is no good for the country. We are just not resolving it and you are not doing anything. So I think they're actually in quite a difficult position on that. I think one of the interesting things about Johnson having a deal is I do think it sort of, you know, makes a second referendum at least have a couple of plausible choices now, because there is at least now a deal that is owned by some Brexiteers that you can put up against Remain. And that was never true with Theresa May's deal, because there were so many people saying that was Brexit in name only, it wasn't the real deal. I do at least think you could, if you ever got to a second referendum, I still think that's pretty unlikely, but you could actually say there is the Brexiteers' Brexit given to you by Boris, one of the leaders of the Leave campaign, versus Remain. That is much more plausible choice than the one that people might have had before. There'll still be some people like Nigel Farage saying you need to have a proper Brexit, a clean Brexit, etc., etc., etc. But I think it does sort of make that more plausible. One of the things about Boris Johnson is, maybe it's a plus, maybe it's a minus, is that he is clearly more able to pivot than Theresa May, to put it nicely. And if at some point he saw that it was convenient to him to pivot, who knows where he would end up. I mean, you know, everybody says it's amazing he did the deal, but he did the deal because he was prepared so unceremoniously to dump the Democratic Unionists, despite the sort of, you know, all the commitments and larging it at their party, at Tory party conference, things like that. So who knows, maybe he'll pivot again and embrace the full Kyle Wilson.
Yeah, Polly, that's probably one of the only ways in which we get that referendum, isn't it? I mean, certainly number 10 will say, even if Parliament says we want a referendum, you know, we would effectively take that as a wrecking amendment and we would pull the bill and we would have a general election instead because we don't want that referendum. And actually, you need government time and government money and legislation. It's very difficult for Parliament to sort of wave its hand and demand something and get it, isn't it?
But it leaves Labour free to say, look, we never blocked your deal. We always said we'd accept your deal, whatever it is you want, whatever kind of deal you want, we will pass, unamended if you like, but just so long as it goes back to the people. And because of that division you talked about that was in the Shadow Cabinet this week, Labour has mumbled and fumbled on this, and they haven't taken a really clear position. Sadly, time and again, the whole story of the whole Brexit story might have been different if we'd had a really powerful opposition and united opposition taking much stronger positions on Brexit all the way through.
Tom, how different will the framing of an election be
if Brexit is, as it were, done, and Jill will tell me off for saying it's done because it won't be done even if that legislation's gone through. there's a lot still to be determined. But how much difference will that make to the way the debate plays out?
There's a huge difference. So the threat to Boris Johnson of going before a Brexit is delivered is that you have a Brexit party. And that's the big threat to his chances of getting a majority. So that's a concern for them. But the Conservative Party have, under Boris Johnson, successfully squeezed the Brexit Party from a high point in the polls. I think they've sort of halved their numbers. After, though, there are some concerns. There is this analogy that voters will quite rationally say, thank you for winning the war, Boris Johnson. Now I quite fancy socialism. I would like some more money for my school and my hospital, and that nice Mr. Jeremy Corbyn is offering me that. So, and there's nothing irrational about making that decision. It's about saying I would like a soft Brexit and socialism. So that is a threat. But you'd have to say that he is moving again. It's this election campaign that he's already running to close down some of the real weaknesses in Theresa May's campaign. So he's got rid of the social care issue that cost her so much, or has attempted to. He's talking about more money for police, more money for hospitals, more money for schools. So it's not an austerity agenda that he is, at least on the face of it, offering. And he gets to kill the Brexit Party in one go. So it's still, you know, he's formidable on either side.
Well, it wasn't so formidable in PMQs today when he started talking about the NHS spending. I thought that Jeremy Corbyn landed one on him when he went on about, I'm going to build 40 hospitals. There is a way in which Boris Johnson's extravagance of speech will do for him, because every time he's going to be punctured by actual facts, actual spending, and he's not one for detail. So that I think it may well be that in the course of a general election campaign, people aren't going to believe these airy promises at a time, after all, where not a single extra penny has arrived for the NHS, for schools. The money is not there yet, maybe next year. And people can see all around them the effects of 9 years of extreme austerity. I think the analogy that Boris Johnson might quite like is Winston Churchill. He wins the war, he gets Brexit, but he loses the peace.
Exactly. The key difference there is Attlee was very much accepted the whatever that came after the war. We have Jeremy Corbyn potentially with this problematic choice of, do I say to the people, I'm going to overturn Brexit, or do I accept it and say, I'm going to just offer a softer version? That is a problem for Labour.
I think there is a real risk, though, that this should be an election about Brexit if it comes soon, because actually the withdrawal agreement is just the terms of withdrawal. It's important, but isn't that important to our long-run future. The long-term relationship really matters, and they're offering very different visions. That was the other big change in Boris Johnson's agreement last week, was he went from Theresa May, who basically, you know, she was striving to be pretty close to the single market. She had a problem about stopping free movement, but she was really wanting to be really quite close to the single market, except lots of EU regulation. She wants to be as near as possible on customs and things like that. He doesn't. He wants a very different Brexit. So actually, the Jeremy Corbyn vision of a close relationship, you know, his job's first Brexit, whatever he'll like to call it, soft Brexit, and the Boris vision of a deregulatory, freer economy with regulatory freedoms, goodness knows quite how he wants to use them, able to do trade deals all over the world and things. These are very different visions, and actually that'll be settled. Supposed to be settled by December 2020, which slightly looks deeply implausible, but it is supposed to be settled in what looks like the next parliament. And one of the interesting things is whether the press and broadcasters are all saying, actually, we've done 3.5 years of Brexit. Thank God we can have an election campaign that's not about Brexit, when actually it ought to be about Brexit.
Would be sweet relief, Jill, I have to say. But
damn it, to do us all out of a job.
Don't want to choke my responsibilities. Polly, how will Labour managed to hang on, do you think, to some of those constituents? You would love to see Labour, as you've said, say, you know, we want to overturn this, we want to stop this, we want to have a referendum. But how do they continue to appeal in those seats like Gareth Snell's, where, you know, a lot of people voted to leave?
The big question for both Labour and the Tories is whether those sorts of seats, when it comes to it, those voters really care more about Brexit than they care about anything else, or when it comes to a general election and thinking about all of those services and thinking about the austerity, thinking about the huge cuts, people who've been moved on to universal credit, working hard at 2-3 jobs and seeing their working tax credits cut. When it comes to it, are those bread and butter things really more important? I also think there's a very strong resistance to voting Tory, but particularly for Boris Johnson. I think he personally will be a big negative in those old-fashioned Labour seats.
Yeah, that's interesting. He is a sort of traditional Tory, perhaps, in a way that Theresa May wasn't.
That's right. A traditional Tory, though, that does have some appeal among people who are not Tories. That's the irony of Boris Johnson, the thing that's quite hard to understand. I remember in the 2017 election, going back to where I'm from, which is in the northeast and Sedgefield constituency, just outside Darlington. And all of those seats looked like they were going to go Tory.
The Tories thought they were going to get them, didn't they? Yeah.
They really thought, I mean, they thought Bishop Auckland was in the bag. That's where my nan lives. And that looked absolutely nailed on. And Darlington looked nailed on. There were even talk about Sedgefield. And there's a candidate, a Tory candidate, who was, I think, in her 20s and just out of university in Hull. And they were saying that she had a chance of winning in Sedgefield. I was sort of like scratching my head thinking, this is insane, you know, but it looked possible. And Theresa May was incredibly popular at that time. And they were both going after older people, working class older people who were switching. And what actually happened was they did switch, those older people, but there was this huge other group of people that neither side was sending leaflets to or bothering to get in touch with. And they were sort of middle class or middle income, middle-aged people who were doing perfectly fine, and they switched to Jeremy Corbyn. And the Tories did not see that coming at all, and it was values-based, it wasn't on economics mostly. And, you know, look where we are. So I wouldn't take anything for granted.
And you think people like that might take a look at Boris Johnson in a way that they wouldn't have taken a look at Theresa May, potentially?
They might do. I went to Swindon on another one of these trips to try and understand it. And I remember one of the candidates there telling me that the old rules of Tory politics were, if you had a new housing estate built in your constituency, that was a good thing because there were people with jobs moving in who could afford a mortgage and they would increase the Tory majority. And the exact opposite is happening now. So a new housing estate was built in Swindon in this constituency, and it became more marginal because these people were voting Jeremy Corbyn. And
young parents yeah. use the NHS, they use nurseries, they use schools. And what we've seen is the big age divide. This time, the tipping point at which people will vote Conservative will be even higher than it was last time. It's going up rapidly, 2 or 3 years a year. So it's only going to be the old, really.
I had a Labour MP in the northeast. I said, Boris Johnson is a problem for you, isn't he? And he replied, yeah, we're screwed in the short term, but they're screwed in the long term.
Oh, great. Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all our guests, Polly Toynbee, Jill Rutter, Tom McTague, and Peter Walker. The producer was Danielle Stevens. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.